With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. Late in the evening of October 6th, 1894, in the Parkdale neighborhood of Toronto, a white, middle-class, 18-year-old named Frank Westwood was shot by an unknown assailant. He died 3 days later. In a bizarre and complicated series of events, the police eventually arrested 33-year-old Clara Ford, a working-class single mother who happened to be black and also happened to dress in men's clothes. What ensued was a sensational trial that captured the imagination of Canadians across the country. And while all of this occurred in the late 19th century, it is a story that encompasses themes all too familiar today. Themes such as racism, gender identity, sexuality, and police brutality. This is Season 8, Episode 11, Clara Ford and the Parkdale Murder That Excited a Nation. For today's story, I decided to bring in an expert to help us sort of parcel out the approach to this incredible tale. That expert is Dr. Carolyn Weitzman. Dr. Weitzman is a housing and social policy consultant, and she is an expert advisor to the Housing Assessment Resource Tools, HART, project based at the University of British Columbia, which is developing standardized best practices for housing needs, land, and acquisition assessments using detailed open data. Carolyn is the author, co-author, or lead editor of 6 books, over 100 book chapters, peer-reviewed articles, and major reports. She has provided expertise to national, state, provincial, and local governments, United Nations Women, United Nations Habitat, and private and nonprofit organizations. But for the purposes of today, Dr. Weitzman has recently published a book, and it's called Clara at the Door with a Revolver, and this was published by UBC Press this year, and this is the book recommendation for the episode. I began our discussion by asking Dr. Weitzman what was the status of Black Canadians at the end of the 19th century.
Right. So I think the way I characterize it in the book is that Canada was a temporary and contingent refuge for certainly for Black refugees from the U.S. There had been slavery in Canada. I think the Hanging of Angelique by Afua Cooper does a really good job of talking about that. When Ontario, then called Upper Canada, was formed, it was led by Governor Simcoe, who was anti-slavery. He came up with a remarkably mealy-mouthed compromise, which phased out slavery. As it turned out, slavery phased out about the time that it was abolished in the British Empire, 1834. So there's no doubt that Canada had a history of vicious racism and enslavement. However, it was safer in the early 19th century for Black people, and about 17,000 people came up from the US and settled mostly in Western Ontario. There were 500 Black people in the census in 1861, which was the year that Clara was born. There were also 500 people in 1891, when Toronto had grown from a city of about 60,000 to a city of 250,000. So there was a Black presence. There were some people who did very well indeed. Wilson Abbott was a successful land developer. His son became a famous doctor who helped in the Civil War. William Hubbard in the 1890s, about the time of the trial, was deputy mayor. He was Black. So there were examples of Black people hitting the middle class. The vast majority of Black people, however, were working class, strongly ghettoized, and in general, very subject to the same kinds of racist harassment and threats. And I include a quote from John A. MacDonald in, again, from the early 1860s, saying that if there wasn't the death penalty for rape, there would be widespread violence by Black men against white women, and then there might be lynching, and so we need the death penalty for rape. So there was a lot of those kinds of really harmful and hurtful stereotypes, and Black people had a lot of scrutiny cast on them, and that's very much exemplified in Clara's story.
So then who was Clara Ford?
Clara was a woman who spent most of her life until the age of 33, when she was arrested and charged with murder, in Toronto. She spent a few times going to the U.S. in search of employment, as many Canadians did at the time. She was a tailoress, a very skilled worker, but she quite often couldn't find work as a tailoress. She was the daughter of a single mother, a white woman. There were a bunch of lies told about, at least I argue that there are lies in the book, told about her parentage, that her foster mother took her in as an act of charity. I very much doubt that's true. She was a strong, resourceful, smart, well-read person, and very musical. After the trial, she became she joined the first all-Black vaudeville troupe and became a dancer. So a woman of many skills, a woman of extreme poverty, someone looked at with disdain and labeled a lot because she was mixed race, because she was sometimes seen in men's clothes, that is wearing pants, and because as the daughter of a single mother, and herself the daughter, the mother of two daughters without a man in sight, very, very suspect to the 19th century.
That's really fascinating. I wonder if you could expand a little bit more on this wearing men's clothes aspect of her. What did you pull from that sort of story about, in regards to this sort of this gender sort of this challenge to traditional gender roles of the time?
It's so frustrating for me because all we have are Clara's words as translated by her friends, and she told a lot of different stories to her friends. So it would appear that she lived as a man for a period of time in her teens in the United States. We don't have any direct evidence for that. We just have stories. When she was arrested, she had pants and a jacket, men's pants and a jacket, which she said she picked up at a pawn shop and which she wore occasionally in order to feel safer in the streets. Because she was Frank Westwood, the murder victim, lived for a short period after he was shot, and he said he'd been attacked by a man. The police were delighted to find a men's suit of clothes, and that meant that they could charge Clara 6 weeks later. The newspapers went wild. And actually, the first mention that I have found of a homosexual, the term homosexual in a North American North American newspaper, was part of a two-page spread on Clara's alleged perversions. And it was much more about Clara being what we call today transgender than about Clara being attracted to women. So Clara said at the time that there was a journalist in Toronto, Vic Steinberg, who wore men's clothes in order to carry out investigative journalism in bars and in baseball games, and argued that it didn't make her any less of a woman wearing men's clothes. However, the othering of Clara, the creation of this stereotype of a monster, was very much tied with the notion of challenging the gender roles at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating aspect of this story. Not just that she's a Black Canadian, but also that there's sort of this and this specifically that what you point out, this reference to a homosexual in a newspaper article, is very, very interesting for the late 19th century. That type of language seems so much more the century to follow than the 19th century, you know, in sort of a public kind of context.
Throughout the writing of the book, and indeed from the very origins of the book, I was struck by how relevant Clara's story was to events 125 years later, from Black Lives Matters, because a lot of Clara's successful defense was that the police had manipulated her into a false confession. Me Too, because there were claims of sexual assault associated with murder, and very much ignored claims. There were all kinds of relevance to issues today around racism, around stereotypes, around poor single moms, etc. So it was unfortunately extremely resonant. Some things have changed, a lot hasn't changed.
Yeah, and that's what makes the story, like you said, that's really what makes the story pop out, is just how many themes we are dealing with in you know, and how many issues we are still dealing with, like you said, 125 years later. So let's tackle the trial. Let's tackle what kind of made this event occur. What describe to me what occurs and how it leads to a trial, if you don't mind.
Yeah, the simple timeline is that Frank is shot on October 8th, 1894, and dies 3 days later. There's an inquest that finds murder by person or persons unknown. 6 weeks later, due to a tip by the person who was the main suspect, the next door neighbor of Frank, the next door neighbor of Frank in turn mentioned a woman who'd been living in the stables in the back of the house for several years, Clara Ford. A tumbling succession of evidence, at least circumstantial, shows up against Clara. She's arrested. There's a media frenzy, and she's indicted. And then there's a little bit of a pause, because in those days, serious cases like murder had to wait for the assizes, which was a special court to meet. So about 6 months later, her trial takes place. The most famous lawyers of the day are lined up, both for the prosecution, the Crown, B.B. Osler, who is the most famous trial lawyer of his day, and sort of the second most famous trial lawyer of his day, E.F.B. Johnson, is lined up on Clara's defense. The judge is also quite a famous judge, although not a criminal judge, as shows in the trial. And, you know, all of the newspapers are agog. The trial lasts 4 days, which sounds incredibly short in 21st century terms, but was actually very, very long for the 19th century, when most murder trials lasted a day. Clara is acquitted. There's no, like, surprise about this. I mentioned it in, I think, the first page. Is forced to leave Toronto after the trial. So that's sort of the timeline. There's a lot of precedents set in this case. It was just around that time that people were allowed to testify on their own behalf. For the first time, there were changes to the criminal code. So Clara becomes the first woman, second person to testify on her own behalf. And her testimony was key to her acquittal. And as I say, she argued that she gave great detail about how the police forced her into a false confession and was believed by the jury.
Curious Canadian history. We'll be back after the break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, that's really interesting that this is sort of the beginning of people being allowed to sort of testify on their own behalf. So what was the relationship between Clara and the murder victim? So she was living in an adjacent building to the house?
Yes. So it's complicated. The Westwood family had moved into Parkdale in 1891. There was a big economic slump going on there, and they got a quite nice house. It was called a mansion. It wasn't a mansion, but it was a very nice house just on the lakeshore. This was, of course, long before the expressway went through the lakeshore in Toronto. And they were avid boaters. And in fact, Benjamin Westwood, Frank's father, manufactured boats. So it was a perfect location for them. When they moved in 1891, they found out to their discomfort that next door, there was a family called the Clarks. Also, like the Westwoods, Brent liberals, certainly middle class, but declining, partly because the paterfamilias, John Clark, was dying slowly of kidney disease. There were 9 children, all quite like 21 and less. As was common, unfortunately, in the 19th century, by the time he died, he just left behind debts. Now, sometime during the time, between about 1891, when the Westwoods moved in, and 1893, Frank, this 13-year-old boy, in 1891, is living next door to Clara, a 33-year-old woman, because Clara and her mother and her 2 daughters had moved into the stables behind the Clark family in exchange for housekeeping. Clara was in the Clark house a lot and had apparently a heated altercation with Frank when he was in his early teens about some slandering of the Clark girls. So there's some letters and there's a whole bunch of drama. It seems established that Frank and Clara hated one another's guts. And as I also look in the book some harassment, there's no other word for it, that Frank and his friends, racial harassment and sexual harassment, misogynoir, that Frank did against Clara and her family. Eventually, Clara's mother got sick. Clara had to move back downtown to the sort of slum then known as the ward. But Clara continued to go back to Parkdale because her church was there. She was a strong Anglican, and she had a good relationship with the pastor who testified on her behalf. And in Clara's alleged confession, she said that Frank had tried to sexually assault her in the summer of 1894, and that she'd returned in October to exact revenge for this attempted rape.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so when she was finally able to take the stand, could you expand a little more on kind of what she said, to what some of the key points that she sort of presented to tip the scales in her favor?
It's really interesting. My brother is a defense lawyer, and I was talking to him while I was writing the book. In some ways, the accused had more rights in the late 19th century than they do today. So Clara didn't have a right to have a lawyer show up. You'd have to pay for a lawyer. There was no like legal aid or anything like that. But usually what would happen when the police suspected you of a serious crime is that they would arrest you, have minimal discussion with you, and then keep you until the next morning when you appeared before the magistrate and you were arraigned for a trial. In this case, the police picked Clara up at around 3 p.m. and kept her in the police station without access, well, without telling her she was arrested, without access to a friend, which would have been common, or a relative, until 11 o'clock when she confessed. So that was 8 hours. Very unusual for the time. A number of lawyers weighed in and said she shouldn't have been held in that way. Again, there wasn't sort of the reading of the rights or anything like that, but without giving her, well, access to a lawyer through appearing at the magistrate's court the next day. So Clara gave some examples of how the police were trying to manipulate her into a confession.
That's really fascinating. I mean, it certainly shows that Clara had quite a wherewithal to be able to sort of argue in a court of law. I mean, I could only imagine myself trying to go in a court of law today and try to make an argument on my behalf, and how much I'd fail because of not understanding the legal system. And yet Clara is able to sort of stand up and actually sort of win the case on her behalf. I think that's phenomenal.
I call that chapter the performance of her life, and I spend a lot of time on her testimony, partly because it's the closest we're going to get to Clara directly speaking to us. It's the closest to her accurately reported words. And partly because she gave a great performance. She made the audience, the jury, laugh. She brought the jury round to her side by saying, "I'm just this working woman," and the police, who were not in very good repute in the 19th century, were acting in a manner that was completely unacceptable for men to treat women. Now, we can get into the whole question of chivalry and the question of, you know, how women were actually treated, but you're not supposed to be alone with a woman, two men, three women, locked door, no one can see in, for a long period of time. And the jury went, yep, that's really unacceptable.
That's extremely fascinating. So she's found not guilty. Now, one of the interesting things I find about your book, though, is that you talk about the way her story is remembered. So actually, before we do that, so why don't we talk about the rest of her life, and then we'll talk about the way the story is remembered. So what happens to Clara after the trial, and how does her sort of life unfold from then?
Well, we know very little about her life, but we know that she had always been interested in the theater. Her alibi for the night of the murder was that she'd been at the theater. And there was this pioneering Black vaudeville troupe called Sam T. Jack's Creole Company. It was owned by a white man. Sam T. Jack was white, but it had many of the early forerunners of jazz, gospel, comedy, etc., and had a host, Florence Hine, who was a not just a male impersonator, in other words, a woman wearing men's clothes, but also was almost playing, wearing white face, not literally wearing white face, but her persona was a rich white young man, which I found fascinating. So the last we know of Clara really is that she went off to join the vaudeville, which is again a very gutsy move for a 33-year-old woman, you know, to decide I'm going to start a new career as a dancer. I mean, she just was an amazing, I was fascinated by Clara. That's sort of her life after the trial, but you were leading into something, I believe.
Oh yeah. Well, cause now what was interesting is of course how this is all remembered. And there's a man you mentioned, Hector Charlesworth, and perhaps you could wrap him into how this whole story does get remembered.
Hector is my villain of the piece. So Hector was a young journalist. He was a very ambitious journalist. He, even at the age of 23, had already worked for two other newspapers, including Saturday Night Magazine, which was just starting up then. He worked for a paper called The World. It was a tabloid. He was trying to boost the circulation by any means necessary. He made up so many stories about Clara. He was the person who did the two-day, four-page spread about Clara being a homo-sexual. And then he wrote his memoirs in the 20s. He went on to be fairly well-known theater critic. And in his memoirs, there are three pages devoted to the Clara Ford trial containing 12 demonstrable lies in them. And that's the version that everyone who's referred to Clara from that point forward, from the 20s forward, uses. So for instance, he says that she was having an affair with Frank and got jealous, and that's why she shot him. He says that she went around bragging about the murder first to pickpocket Gus Clark, who actually was her former landlord and was a thief, but no way was she bragging to him. She hated his guts. He said that she went out on the stage afterwards and bragged about Frank's murder. Again, we would know if she'd done that. She did not do that. So that's the version that's made it into there's been one book written about the case. There's been a couple of articles written. There's been a lot of, like, every once in a while it crops up in newspapers or in websites, you know, look at this amazing murder from 1895. And they're all relying on that completely made up stuff by a viciously racist, you know, again, a very contemporary theme, fake news. He was Fox News. He was fake news.
Wow. What, like, did he have an axe to grind, or was this just sort of like a story that he felt he would sort of build his career on by, like, completely, you know, lying about stuff and creating the sensationalism around it?
Well, both. Even by the standards of his time, his father had been a politician who, like John A. Macdonald, supported the South in the U.S. Civil War. He grew up in Windsor, which was one of the crossing points for the Underground Railroad. And he says in his memoir, I saw Black people and I was really scared when he was growing up before he moved to Toronto. So he was a vicious racist, but also he was a very, very ambitious journalist, and he was doing what he could to boost ratings. Another little stunt that he pulled was about a week after the murder, he sent some clippings to author Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, right, and said, we need Sherlock Holmes to solve this mystery. And Arthur Conan Doyle, a very polite man, wrote this letter back saying, I can't really come to any opinion, thank you. And that was front page headlines. Even Sherlock Holmes is stumped. You know, I'm going to give him point for cleverness. But again, you know, there was a book written in 1970 about author Conan Doyle detective. And it mentions, you know, the Clara case and says, the story is taken from the Hector Charlesworth memoirs, all of the lies that I just detailed. So he was very successful at slandering, at libeling Clara.
I guess this is a kind of more of a historiographical question, but has there been any, besides your book, has there been any other serious attempts to sort of liberate the story from that narrative?
There was a book written 15 years ago called Death in the Queen City that mostly focuses on the trial and doesn't show much interest in Clara herself. And in that book, there are a couple of the Charlesworth lies, although the book does a very good job of talking about the legal context. It's written by a legal historian, Patrick Brode. As I mentioned towards the end of the book, there is a wonderful piece of art, a sculpture made by a Black artist named Anik Jordan that tries to give a new view of Clara as, you know, a stubborn survivor, which I'd say is my view of Clara. I'm not going to say she's a hero. I'm not going to say she was a civil rights activist. Right. She was doing everything she could do to survive. And she had an arsenal. She was smart. She was funny. Yep. She was articulate. She was brave. And that's what saved her from being hanged.
That leads us into our final question. And I think there's a lot to answer to this, but I mean, what kind of legacy does Clara's story provide, first of all, in how we understand race in Canada, the history of Black Canadians, but I think there's gender issues or sexuality issues and things like that. So I know this is a big question, but perhaps tackle it. What kind of legacy comes out of all of this, do you think, understanding it from a modern day perspective, especially?
Well, I think that people who read the book will be interested in several aspects of it. I mean, as you say, it brings together a lot of threads. The question of policing, questions around the rights of the accused, questions around gender and sexuality that I wish I could answer in some ways, but, you know, all I can do is depend on Clara's words. So I don't know how Clara would have today identified her gender. I think one of the things that really attracted me to Clara is I've always been fascinated by social history. I've always been interested in how single moms survived. What did they pay for rent? What did they eat? You know, how did they manage with insecure employment? And to have a, you know, amazing, colorful, fascinating, three-dimensional character like Clara help me answer those questions was part of what drew me to the story. Absolutely, the murder mystery aspect of it is going to interest people, but I want to really stress that this isn't a novel. A couple of people have congratulated me on my novel, and it's like all dialogue guaranteed true, you know, or at least all dialogue guaranteed from newspapers, which may or may not be true. It is such a fascinating story. It is one of those cases where truth is way more interesting than fiction. And I hope that readers will, and like people who don't usually read social history, will be attracted to it, learn more about Canada's often hidden past, and question that, you know, self-image that Canada still has as a nice country. You know, it's not nasty, it's not nice. There's a lot of really vexed history around racism and around treatment of the other that I think Clara helps unpack.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBorys. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.